the committee would come to order, please.
Yeah.
This is the Finance Committee meeting. It is Monday, April 24th, 7:20 in the evening, continuation of the meeting from earlier this afternoon. I'd like to first have the committee take up the House CS for Senate Bill 289. We do have a W draft in the packet. And Mike, if you would just come forward and explain the changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mike Tibbles. Two changes were made in the version W work draft that you should have before you. First change is on page 4, line 1. We reduced the amount of the percentage of wages from 2/10 to 1/10 of a percent, and that's in section 3 of the bill.
Page 4, line 1.
I'm sorry, that's in...
Which version?
Let me see.
Backslash W.
Thank you.
Bearing here.
And that's the employee contributions for the program. We reduced, again, Mr. Chairman, reduced the amount from 0.2% to 0.1%. And then, in addition, we changed the first year operation amounts under section 4, page 6. The percentages that were in the original bill were university 76%. You can see we changed that to 52. Kotzebue was 8%. That went up to 16%. And Avtec went from 16 to 32%.
And that is the provisions for use of the funds in the first year. Do the committee members have questions on the CS?
Yeah.
Representative Davies?
I understand the things that you just did, but is the funding of the STEP program in this as well?
The funding for the STEP program is attached on the fiscal note, is that correct?
Is it intended to keep that there?
I'm sorry?
Intend to keep it there?
My intent was to pass the fiscal note out with these modifications shown. And, of course, the fiscal note will still be in play until the closeout of the conference committee.
There's something on the bottom of page 2.
We'll take a brief at ease.
Bottom of page 2 in the fiscal.
If we come back to order, Representative Davies, did you continue to have a question on the W version before we entertain a motion to adopt it?
No, I'm fine, thanks.
Representative Mulder?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the slash W version in lieu of the other bill for HB 289, or SB 289.
Okay, there is a motion to adopt the backslash W as the working document. Is there any objection? Seeing none, that version in the bill is before us as the working document. Are there questions from committee members? Mr. Perkins, did you feel the urge to make a comment?
I do. I would like to, first of all, thank the senator for reducing this to, or lowering it to 0.1%. It's certainly in the right direction, going down. We do feel that 0.05 would be a better number, and I'll leave it at that.
Any questions from committee members? Seeing none, then Mike, do we need new fiscal notes, or do you have the numbers on the change to the fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman, I do have the numbers for the change. We could do a replacement fiscal note for the Senate Finance Committee, and the previous number was 6,450,000. New number would be 3,225,000 at 0.1%.
Okay, and that would just be a House Finance fiscal note. Any questions then on the fiscal impact of the bill? Any amendments to come before the committee? Representative Davis?
Mr. Chairman, do we have a comment or thumbs up from the sponsor?
I see a thumbs up.
House brevity.
Oh, and Mike, the fiscal note for the funding for the STEP program.
Chairman, that there should be two fiscal notes in the packet. One for $4,553,800, which mirrors the governor's FY01 amended request for the STEP program. And then the new fiscal note by House Finance Committee for the number that I mentioned, $3,225,000.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Davies?
Both of those things are based on 1%. Why are they different?
I think the STEP funding, oh, I see, because the STEP funding currently is 1%. Is that what you're asking?
Tenth of 1%.
Tenth of 1%. Come forward.
For the record, Mr. Chair, Mary Jackson with Senator Torgerson, 3 months behind time on the new bill, the new program. So it's effectively only a 9-month collection time frame instead of 12.
Whereas the STEP is 12.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. So for the record, the STEP funding is 12 months worth, and the new program is 9 months worth. So that explains that difference in numbers. So, Mike, again, do we just have the two fiscal notes, or is there one here from Department of Labor, Employment Security, Unemployment Insurance for $200,000? What is that no longer valid?
That would probably have to be. I'd have to look at that one, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if that would be
Dwight Perkins, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Labor and Workforce Development. I believe that one was based on the 2/10. So I think it would be half of that. But I'll have to check with our Admin Services Director, Ramon Henderson, and play a catch-up to this thing in the morning if it would please the committee.
Okay, so there are three fiscal notes.
And, you know, we would correct it by morning for you.
Any further questions from the committee members? Any amendments to come before the committee? What's the pleasure of the committee? Representative Foster?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move out SB 289 out of committee with individual recommendation.
There is a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations. Any objection? Seeing none, it will move from committee. We will have the one House Finance Committee fiscal note, and we'll look for a new one from Department of Labor on the other issue. Okay, with that, we will then take up House Bill 1, Senate Bill 177.
Senator Donnelly here. Senator, has this language been distributed to other members?
I think it's I think we have we have two things. We have a Z version, and then we have a short proposed amendment.
Just a second. If you go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the Z version that's before the committee now clarifies the changes occur in Section 9, that's on page 4, from the version the committee saw earlier. And it makes it clear that if there is a violation of a single act under the Unfair Trade Practices Act, and it makes it very specific that we're talking about only the Unfair Trade Practices Act there, the director may take, may require restitution or issue a cease and desist order if there's a loss or harm, but the director can't impose an actual monetary penalty or do remedial action other than cease and desist and restitution unless there was both a loss or harm and it was an intentional act. And I support this change. I think it's a reasonable step because never before has the director had the authority to take action on single acts. And it's limited to just this section, the Unfair Claims Practices Act, so it would not affect, and that's what this other proposed language super clarifies, would not affect the director's authority to take action when there's a single act that is in violation of the licensing portions of the insurance code. So the director would maintain their authority to deal with violations in the licensing section, but for the new power, the authority the director would have regarding single acts for violations of 2136 and 125, the Unfair Claims Practices Act, they could take action to make the consumer whole through restitution and also to or issue cease and desist orders. And I think I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that that is a really significant step forward for consumers in Alaska. It allows the division to protect consumers. At the same time, it moderates the impact upon insurance companies so that if they just have an innocent single mistake, they're not going to get hammered with a fine and other remedial action other than what would be appropriate and necessary to protect the consumer, which is, of course, cease and desist and restitution. So I would suggest to the committee that this is a good compromise. I support it. And I would also, in meeting with Director Lohr, and we haven't been able to get him on the phone the last little bit here, there was some concern, and I do think this is specific enough not to raise that concern, but just there was some concern that somehow this would limit the director's powers in other areas to do meridian. I don't know why I can't say it. It's just really hard for me to say tonight for some reason. I'm sorry, gentlemen. And so this other language just makes it really clear that we're not limiting the director's powers under the licensing or other portions of the insurance code. We want him to retain those powers so that if there's even a single act in licensing, which can be very significant and problematic involving frauds and such, they still have the power to take that kind of action where they may be ordering other types of remedies. And and I think we've reached that we're okay with this proposed amendment number one also, to try to address and make it just crystal clear that the changes that are in the Z version committee substitute, you know, adding this language, make it really clear that they wouldn't have any negative effect on the director's powers in other areas. So I would support amendment number one also. As to amendment number two, I don't think it's necessary, and I think we've kind of reached a very fine-tuned compromise here, and it's certainly a big step forward for consumers, and it's really positive that now with this version, I think we have the industry on board too. So I think it's got a lot to speak for it without, and I wouldn't support amendment number two at this time, Mr. Chairman, or I wouldn't support amendment number two. I think we've got a good compromise with these.
Senator, Mr. Lohr is online.
Okay.
Mr. Lohr, are you online right now?
Mr. Chairman, as long as Senator Donnelly is advocating our interests, I'll pretend I'm not, but yes, I am.
Okay, Representative Davies has a question, then Grusinor.
No, I was just going to move number one.
Okay. So we have first of all, do we need a motion to adopt the Z? Representative Mulder?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the slash Z version as a working document.
Is there objection to that motion? Seeing none, that will be the working document before us. Representative Grusendorf?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, from the S version judiciary, and then the T version, and now the Z version, which actually reads clearer and is smoother, but it really is the same thing as the T version, just sentences turned around, and it still leads me to the concern, and is intentional. I mean, all I see is you cleaned up, made it run smooth and don't have dangling things there, but I don't see any change in this. What would be your feelings if we said instead of and is, or is?
Senator?
Mr. Chairman, one real positive change in the Z version is we've absolutely clarified that this language only applies to 2136125, the Unfair Claims Practices Act. That little, that specific enumeration of the statute wasn't in the earlier version. So we've made it really clear that these limits on the director's powers as to single acts don't apply to the other parts of the insurance code, because we don't want the director limited from taking remedial action in the other parts of the insurance code. So that's an important...
Chairman, it was in the T version which we're dealing with. So what did you do?
Well...
Other than change a sentence around.
I think maybe that's... I didn't think the T version... If the T version has the 2136-125 in it, I don't think that had actually been adopted by the committee before.
Representative Grusendorf, you're right. We've just cleared up the language. I think the problem that you expressed this afternoon is still here. But the language earlier in the day was very cumbersome. Even this language is somewhat redundant. And if you look on line 14, it starts off, results in a loss or harm, and then we reiterate that down on line 16, unless the violation results in loss or harm. The second loss or harm is really not necessary, but I guess the drafters felt that if you want to really make clear that...
Mr. Chairman, it reads better, but the results are still the same.
That's right. Your concern is not addressed by this change. Representative Davies, did you have another question, or do you want to move amendment number one?
If you're ready. Yeah, I would move number one.
Okay, Representative Davies has moved amendment number one. It's T.1. Representative Davies?
Mr. Chairman, I'll object. I think... Senator Donnelly indicated that Mr. Lohr hadn't had time to review.
Mr. Chairman, we were trying to call him, but obviously he was on the line, so we couldn't get through it. That's why
he has amendment number one.
So I think he does have a copy of amendment number one. Maybe he could comment on it.
I could get his response. To
Mr. Lohr, have you received amendment number one, and do you have a comment on it?
Just, Bob, it's the T.1 42400 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Donnelly, I haven't seen it. Your staff read me a version, and if I can just clarify or just ask you to briefly read it, then I can be happy to comment on it as best I can.
Okay, and for the committee members, I think actually the amendment needs to say page 4, line 16. That'll just be a technical change.
Yeah.
And I'll just read it to you. It would add a sentence on that would say, this subsection does not affect the director's authority to impose a penalty for multiple acts prohibited under AS 2136-125 or a penalty for an act prohibited under a provision of law other than AS 2136-125.
Mr. Chairman, the division supports that amendment, and if you'd like for the economy of us, I could address the intent question now or separately.
I'm sorry, you supported, and then I didn't...
If you wish me to address the intent question that Representatives Grusendorf and Davies have raised, I could do that very briefly right now or as a separate discussion, if you will.
We've got a pending motion on the amendment. Let's deal with that first. Is there objection still to the motion to adopt amendment number one? Seeing none, then amendment number one will be adopted. Now, Mr. Lohr, regarding Representative Grusendorf's comment and concern.
Just briefly, I'm truly sorry that full consensus on enforcement of single act authority has not been possible. We have worked hard with both the industry and especially with the sponsor of the bill to try to achieve full consensus. And I appreciate the indulgence of the committee at this very late date in your process to accommodate trying to bridge that gap. We do agree that the language in the Z version, especially as now amended, is less ambiguous and conflicted than the earlier draft. However, it does not resolve the issue of intent. And given that the committee's will appears to be that that intentional wrongdoing by the person accused of a Section 125 single act violation is your will, and believe that the best way to accomplish that and still have a process that works for enforcement at all would be if the burden is on the person accused to establish the reasonableness of their conduct. It basically said that the person has the burden of going forward to show that their action was not intentional. That would then put it on the division to come back with some evidence that it was, and then the neutral finder of fact would reach a conclusion on that, which would be decided by the division director and then ultimately reviewed by Superior Court if necessary. That, to me, is not ideal, but it is a very manageable approach to having intention required, but also having the person with the intent who's best evidence, best able to speak to that question, be responsible for putting on the record what their view of what they were thinking at the time. Be happy to answer any questions on that view.
Thank you. Representative Davis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and that's what Amendment number two does. It's bolded on the bottom that the burden of the person accused of the single act violation, that the burden is on the accused as opposed to the department.
Representative Mulder?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, what's the difference between saying unintentional or just putting or in? Because in my opinion, you're getting back to the point of if you say unintentional, you may as well just go back to or, because it's the same net effect.
Mr. Chairman, Co-Chairman Mulder, I believe that putting a burden of going forward on the person would be a lesser, it still requires a finding of intentional conduct by the division. It simply gives us the benefit of the evidence from the only person that really knows what was in his or her heart, or at least mine, at the time. I do believe that is a higher standard of proof for the division than simply excluding intent at all as a factor, which is what Orr would do in the judiciary version.
Still strikes me, Mr. Chairman, as you're putting an awful lot of, the point about it is they've already got a pretty big hammer. What intentional does is the knockout punch. I mean, when you're coming after somebody in this means, you're looking you better be pretty darn certain that you've got a bad actor here. And by giving them the ability to go after them the way we have within Section 9, you've given them a hammer. I think the only thing that remains is by making it intentional is the knockout punch.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Davis.
I think it'd be pertinent to put Amendment number 2 on the table, so I move Amendment number 2.
Object.
There is a motion and an objection. Representative Davis.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, I don't know how much of a problem it is one way or another. I mean, for something, how often is this going to happen? It's going to be something that's probably pretty raunchy for someone to do, I would think. Some pretty bad act. And how much of a burden for the department to prove it is going to be, I mean, I don't know if any of us can tell. I don't know if Mr. Lohr or anybody has an example of what we're even talking about, what sort of an act we're talking about, how much of a burden for the department to prove. I was just trying to, and I think this amendment tries to take that burden away and puts it over on the person being accused. I mean, so that's, there's no question what the intent is.
Representative Davies?
Just a question to the maker of the amendment. I think it may not be quite doing what you're intending.
I've read it a couple times.
But it says may not impose a penalty unless the person can show the violation is unintentional. I think it should be unless the person cannot show that the violation is unintentional.
I read it a couple times, Representative Davis, and I'm not quite sure where you're going. Seems like a couple of double negatives.
I'm not sure, but I think you want to say cannot show.
Unless the person can show that the violation is unintentional.
Why would you want to impose the stricter penalty if it was an unintentional act.
But yeah. May impose a penalty.
May not impose a penalty.
Well, then that would have to be unless the person cannot show.
No, you're right.
Unintentional. May not impose.
No, it should, you got to either take the one knot out or put another one in.
Right.
Richard.
pretty naughty question.
Rick Sarah Foster.
I don't know. I don't know anything about law, but I'm sure old English law, you know, if you accuse somebody of something, the burden of proof is on you to show that he's guilty. The burden of proof isn't on the accused to show that he's innocent. I think I'm the only one around this table. Heck, I faced a fine of $10 million in 40 years in somewhere not too long ago. And I didn't have to prove that I was innocent. The burden of proof is on the other person. Otherwise, people would be going up and down the street accusing everybody of something.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Lohr?
Just briefly, if I might respond, Senator Foster, I believe that for a criminal standard, the burden of proof would be on the state, on the prosecutor. In this case, it's a civil violation, and we're not really putting the burden of proof on the person accused of a single civil violation. What we're doing is saying that they have the burden of going forward, which is different from the burden of proof, and it's even different from the burden of persuasion, in that they simply have to go first and give us what their statement is. Give us the story, give us the reasonable explanation for why it is not intentional, and then the burden shifts, as the lawyers tell me, to the division to rebut that prima facie statement by the person with the burden of going forward. What it does require them to give us some statement that it was intentional, some explanation of why, and then the ball shifts to our court.
Well, why would anybody want to do that? It'd be easier just to get a lawyer, otherwise you incriminate yourself.
Mm-hmm. Again, for criminal conduct, that would be true, but we do accept the cooperation of industry with respect to dealing with problems.
We're not talking about the large companies here.
We're talking about is possibly a bad apple from time to time, a company located outside with a very limited number of claims in Alaska that simply finds it economically to their advantage to seriously fleece one customer rather than making good their corporate responsibility. And we do not regard this as to any large participant in the Alaska market. I believe it would be a highly infrequent event that we would be pursuing a single act violation.
Yeah, but he's liable to a fine of up to $1 million for each violation, and he can revoke or suspend his license.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct with respect to violation of a cease and desist order only, and a fine can only be imposed by superior court. The limit for what we're talking about in this case would be a maximum fine of $2,500. So I believe that the monetary fine, virtually everyone could agree, is not the issue here. It's the other penalties that people are concerned about.
Representative Phillips.
One part of the discussion that we had the other day that still is not clear in my mind is by leaving the word "and" is intentional, that transfers it to a criminal act. The "or" made it a civil act. And that is sticking in my mind.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Phillips, I don't believe that's the case. Even with intentional here, I don't believe that this would flip it to a criminal standard. It would make the standard of proof very similar to that of a criminal act. However, a single violation of Section 125 would not be criminal because the penalties for those are a maximum of $2,500 and possibly remedial measures required, possibly a cease and desist, but certainly not any kind of criminal sanction.
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, going back to Representative Foster's point, I guess I'm not tracking what you're saying because it says, basically, you may not impose a penalty that includes a fine or require remedial action unless the violation is intentional. That gets back exactly to if you go the unintentional route, I'm just not actually reading the language that may not impose a penalty that includes a fine or require remedial action unless the person cannot show that the violation is unintentional. It's getting back exactly to what Representative Foster said. The burden of proof is on you. You're guilty unless you can prove you're innocent. I don't read it any other way. I don't see what you were saying about that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Foster, I'm sorry, Co-Chair Mulder, I believe that that there's no criminal conduct involved here. There's no burden of proof whatsoever. And it might be useful if you would consider amending Amendment Number 2 to indicate that the only burden on the person accused of a violation here would be the burden of going forward. I believe adding that phrase might ensure and just confirm that we're not talking about a criminal accusation, we're not talking about any kind of self-incrimination or violation of a privilege against that. We're simply talking as we do now. Let me give an example. In the case of a multiple violation of the same standard under Section 125, the company cannot be penalized if they have a reasonable explanation for why their conduct, why they violated the same standard twice. And that could include it's an innocent mistake, we had new people on board, a number of explanations. If the division finds that explanation persuasive, they're off the hook. Now, they could say, we don't want to talk to you, but in light of what that standard is, most companies would find it far preferable to make the best case they could for why they shouldn't be penalized. In that case, it's still not criminal, it's still a civil standard, and there's no burden of proof involved. It's simply that the company finds it beneficial to make its case on the record for why its conduct was reasonable in the multiple apparent violations of Section 125.
Representative Foster.
I don't know. You know, I ran an air service for 20 years, and where I was always getting fined by the FAA, and none of it was intentional. You know, a pilot would come in, and he'd forget to tie down his load and get caught by the FAA, or maybe he didn't look at his tachometer, and he was actually flying over 100 hours past the 100-hour check, or, you know. But I am sure a guy could probably establish a pattern here of multiple violations where instead of $2,500, you're liable to quite a bit more. I know if I owned a company, I would never admit that I'd that anything was intentional or that, I mean, it would be easier to get a lawyer and let them deal with you guys. I would never put the burden of innocence on myself. You know, that's your job.
Not if we adopt the amendment.
Representative Davies.
Yeah, well, maybe, Mr. Lohr, I'm not quite following what you're saying either. Maybe, could you tell me a little bit more? I don't know what you mean by the burden of going forward. Is that a technical, is that a term of art or something?
Chairman, Representative Davies, I'm on fairly thin ice there because I'm going back to my recollections from the distant Public Utilities Commission days.
Yeah.
But I know that there is a burden of persuasion, which is a civil analog to the burden of proof in criminal matters. The burden of proof beyond reasonable doubt is, as I understand it, not necessarily a criminal standard. It is an extremely, extremely high standard to meet for anyone. If that is anybody's burden in this case, there will be very few efforts to find single act violations. A lower standard is the burden of persuasion, which means that somebody has to start making the case. And if a company elected to not do that, so be it. They're under no obligation to make any kind of incriminating statement at all, I see. But it does establish who goes first in terms of the order of presenting evidence to a hearing officer. The burden of going forward is essentially just that. It is the accused person has to explain first why it is that their conduct was not intentional. And most people would find it beneficial. The dog ate my homework would be a common sense example of that in elementary school. And most kids would jump at the chance to make the case for why they should be reasonably excused from being late with their homework. I kind of see the same thing occurring here. I do not see it as a difficult burden to meet, and probably mostly an opportunity for the company to make their best foot forward in front of a fair hearing officer.
Senator Donnelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I don't support Amendment Number 2. I think it's well-intended, but I think it disrupts the delicate balance we hear, and I think it's good to remember what we are getting in Section 9. We're getting all the authority I think the director needs to protect individual consumers from single acts. The director can issue a cease and desist order. And believe me, if once that cease and desist order is issued, any wise person in the industry is not going to violate that, because then obviously you've created, you've taken it to the next level. You have a practice because you've got more than one act in this way. And there's lots of other penalties can be invoked at that time. You have restitution. We've never had the ability before for the director to order restitution for individual acts for consumers, and that's really important. So we're preserving really the most important elements here of what it's going to powers for the director to make it right for individual consumers. At the same time, we're creating a balance here to not endanger overly penalizing innocent acts by the industry
when they're just one time. And this issue of reversing the burden of proof here is just that. It basically, it's really it's a preponderance of the evidence standard. I mean, and before you were imposed something like a monetary fine, I think it's appropriate to require the government to show that there was some sort of intent. And I think the main issues that consumers are going to care about and for single acts are already, the power is clearly there for the director to correct those. And if there's, you know, I think it's really valuable that the cease and desist order is there, because that really sets it up for any second violation, you know, to prevent future violations from occurring. So I do not support Amendment Number 2. I do think we have a good product here now.
Question.
Representative Grusendorf, and then we'll get to the question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Lohr, you're still there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Grusendorf, I'm here.
Okay, we have Amendment Number 2, and it reads very much like the T version of Section 9 before we started with Z. Wouldn't it be simpler just to take the AND in the Z version and turn it into OR is intentional?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grusendorf, I hate to argue the opponent's point of view on this to the amendment. However, I do believe Representative Mulder had a point that the OR just takes intent off the table. It leaves it on there as an added possible way of violating Section 125, but it takes it off the table for all other single violations of 125. Therefore, it would be a lower standard than what is proposed in Amendment Number 2, which does put the burden of persuasion or the burden of going forward as you choose on the accused, but it does not, it still treats intent as a necessary factor for a monetary penalty or for restitution other than cease and desist and, remediation other than cease and desist and restitution.
Well, wouldn't the or is an intentional, wouldn't that be more or less a defense for the individual that was... it would be more for the defense of the company, but then you tie it in with the other things, loss or harm.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grusendorf, I believe using or intentional would put intent on the same level as loss or harm. That is, any one of those three could trigger single enforcement act. Single act enforcement by the division, including monetary penalty and other forms of remediation. And under the the amendment proposed, Amendment Number 2, intent is a higher standard that has to be met before any monetary penalty or remediation other than restitution and cease and desist could be imposed.
So, Mr. Lohr, you're saying Amendment Number 2 or... no further alterations?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grusendorf, without support of the site with his sponsor, yes. Amendment Number 2 is preferable from the division's perspective.
And if Amendment Number 2 fails?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grusendorf, I believe Senate Bill 177 does represent an important advance in the enforcement authority of the division in a number of ways that I outlined this afternoon and will not repeat unless requested to do so.
Okay.
But even with the intent in there, I believe it's better than nothing. I think it is an important step forward. However, I do think that enforcement of 125 will be much more difficult, if not virtually impossible, under the intent standard when the division has the burden.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have a motion and objection. We'll have a roll call vote then on Amendment Number 2.
Representative Williams?
No.
Representative Osterman?
No.
Representative Bundy?
No.
Representative Davies?
No.
Representative Davis?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Grusendorf?
Yes.
Representative Phillips?
Yes.
Representative Terrio?
No.
Representative Mulder?
No.
27.
Amendment Number 2 fails. Are there any further amendments to come before the committee? I don't remember, did we discuss the fiscal note? Senator, is it just the 1-0 fiscal note?
Yes, correct, Mr. Chairman.
So that would stay the same. Representative Mulder?
Unless there are further discussion, Mr. Chairman, I move that we pass through committee, House Finance Committee, substitute for Senate Bill 177 as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the bill will move from committee. That will wrap up our meeting for the day.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr.
We have a meeting notice tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock in the morning, on Senate Bill 270 and bills previously heard. So with that, we're done for the day. Please don't forget to sign the committee report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Law.
Every time you...